Flimsy stands slowing you down? Well, it's time to upgrade. Armadillo builds durable, North American-made tablet stands and kiosks. We're so confident, we offer a lifetime warranty. So, elevate your business and visit armadillo.com. That's armodillo.com and use code ACAST for 5% off. Armadillo. Built to last. Designed to impress.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
The Tunaris podcast is proudly sponsored by Inline Eco, your trusted partner in asbestos removal and re-roofing services across Ireland. Your peace of mind and safety are our top priorities. For more information, visit inlineeco.ie.
My name is Mark Lydon. I'm the governor here in Loughlin House. It's an open centre in County Cavan, just outside Blacklyon. It's a low security prison. We have 140 capacity. When you get here, it's different from what you'd be used to. It's different for us all. But here is great. You've got the visits, which are every day, all day long. There's no time limit on your visits. The kids can come up. They can see, honestly, a fabulous environment. It doesn't feel at all like a prison. There's a lot going on here. We've got the school as well. And one of our new innovations here with our music teacher, Andrew, is we formed a jail band. They're actually pretty good. It's a much, much more relaxed atmosphere. It's a low staffing model. You get an awful lot more responsibility. You work your way up to getting your temporary release programs where you go home once, maybe twice a month to be with your family. I think it's a great place to finish up your sentence, and I hope you enjoy the film that's coming and you get to see what we have to offer.
Hello everybody and welcome back to the Two Norries podcast. I'm your host James and I'm joined as always by my good friend Timmy Dan.
Hi everyone.
And we're up in Loughlin House Open Prison in County Cavan, Blacklyon. Yeah. Nice back there.
We have a past guest on today.
How are you doing, lads?
Yeah.
Damien Quinn.
Yeah, how are things?
Well, 2 years since you were on.
2 years since I was on, yeah. And it's good to come back and kind of recap on where we were then and where we are now.
Before we get into that, what's it like being back in Loughlin House because you were here as a prisoner?
Well, I was just saying there on the way in, like when I was here, like you might remember on the last podcast I mentioned my weekend away.
Yeah, do you want to give us a reminder of what happened?
Well, it was the weekend of the Man United and Chelsea 2008 Champions League final. I wasn't really happy up here.
Just before, Loughlin House is one of the open prisons as well in Ireland.
Yeah.
Just to confirm that.
Yeah. But like the education unit is outside the gate, so you can walk in and out the gate, you know, like so. This particular morning, well, after the final, I said I'd take a weekend for myself with a view of getting sent back to the block because I was doing different education down there that wasn't available here. So that was the plan, to get sent back. Got sent back after taking a weekend and got to continue my studies in Castlereagh. So I haven't actually been back up here since I took that weekend. But it's great to come back and check out the scenery because it is a nice place to look out across the lake there and all that stuff. So
it's a nice little spot. But when people hear about, you know, people breaking out of prison, they might think of digging holes with a little pick like Shawshank Redemption. But you literally walked out the gate and left the note behind you just to say, look lads, I've not gone far, I just want to go back to the other prison to finish my course. Watch the Champions League and United won,
that's why I wanted to go out and celebrate that. So I came back on the Monday morning as well, but like what I done that day when I left, I just put on 3 changes of clothes and walked out the gate. But I certainly wouldn't be advising people to do that.
Yeah.
And you can actually get more time now for that.
And it's not like you're escaping.
No,
it's completely up to you whether you stay or not.
Yeah.
Because the opportunity to stay here and finish out your sentence here is what every prisoner wants. Mm. So it's not about escaping from one of the main jails and getting over bars or digging a hole. It's like you just walk out the door and you
do your own thing. Like, exactly. Look, it was here for me if I wanted it, but I made it clear to the governor when I first came up I didn't want to be here. Like, I enjoyed the peace of the block, you know. I liked kicking out my door at 7:30 in the evening. I was studying, you know, I had plans. It was just a space I enjoyed. Here, like, it's open, boredom can set in. I myself found myself doing things that I didn't want to be doing. And that's why I met.
But that's what you actually done back there was like knowing that there was a course that you were just completing and you actually genuinely wanted to go back and do it.
Mm.
That happens regular enough with prisoners. They want to finish, and I've heard it as well from other people that because of the course that they were doing and the enjoyment they were getting from it, they've actually asked not to take temporary release from prison because they want to continue. And also, some people feel safer in prison than they actually would in their environment on the outside.
But that was it. Like, I wanted to make the best of a bad situation. I knew that the education and training in prison is every bit as good as the education and training outside of prison. And I wanted to get as much as I could out of a very negative time in my life.
Yeah.
And I did just that. But when they moved me, like, my teachers didn't move with me. Do you know, the people that I relied on heavily for educational support in prison with me, that were doing the same things as me, they didn't move with me either.
Mm.
So I wanted to get back to that security, that education and that structure that I enjoyed while I was in prison.
Mm. And, you know, from that education, just to recap on the last podcast we done, what continued on from that education when you got out of prison that time?
What continued on? That was a problem, like, I suppose. When I got out, there was no continuity, do you know what I mean? Everything that I was working towards, like, I was kind of hoping to get into college when I got out. They wouldn't. I had a meeting with the college and I came through IASIO. They know where I was coming from.
Mm.
They brought me into the college and they asked me about my offending behaviour. Didn't ask me about what I wanted to learn, and I never heard from them again. I couldn't get on the housing list, I couldn't get a job, couldn't volunteer, do you know what I mean?
So you had difficulties when you left?
Huge difficulties, and I ended up right back to where I started within the first 6 months, you know, and I formed one of the statistics where half the people that get out of prison end up back in within the first 3 years, and like, that's firmly because of a lack of access to opportunity in my head. It's what I experienced. So
that actually correlates with what you're actually doing at the moment. You learned from that experience that something needs to be done.
Yeah.
So just give people a bit of an understanding of what you do at the moment.
Yeah. So, like, the whole journey, like, I always struggled when it came to vetting. Vetting was always the Achilles heel that I struggled with, do you know what I mean? Everywhere I went, I'd always try and put my best foot forward, and I'd be forced into a situation where I'd have to talk about something I was trying to forget about and move on from, and it was a very, very hard thing to turn that discussion from a place of negativity to positivity. So I always felt like we needed something else that would support people and capture what's right and what's strong today rather than what was wrong all those years ago, like, you know. So we outlined about the idea on the last podcast, you know, this idea of Spiranua, you know, this new positive disclosure model, a strengths-based disclosure model. It was actually the first time I spoke about it publicly was with both of you.
Yeah.
Breaking
news.
Breaking news, yeah.
Yeah.
But where we're at today, like, after, like, speaking to you, after doing all the research on it and everybody kind of seeing merit in what I was saying, I pitched that idea to Social Entrepreneurs Ireland.
Can you just give us a little bit of a description what Spiranua is again, just for some of the listeners that may not have heard first podcast?
Yeah, so predominantly Spiranua is like peer mentoring program, and what we do is we support each other to kind of identify our strengths,
mm-hmm.
to, you know, document our steps out of a life of crime, what we're doing right, our educational pathway, our, you know, abstinence from drugs and all that kind of stuff, our plans, our goals, our aspirations, and we get that all assessed and we see, you know, have these goals and aspirations been met, you know, certified, all that type of stuff, and we document it and we set it up in like a portfolio of commitment to change, and then that's passed over then to be assessed by the criminal justice system based on their own benchmarks of rehabilitative outcomes. So when that happens, then it brings it right up to date, and if you can imagine, like, a safe pass for people with convictions, that's pretty much what we're offering.
Okay.
And, you know, like, if you want to start something up like that, or if you have an idea, like, how do you go about it? How do you get funding? Or do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, well, look, when I came off, it was a college project, and rather than gather dust on a shelf, you know, everybody was saying, yeah, that makes sense, I couldn't shake the idea, so I pitched that idea to Social Entrepreneurs Ireland. I remember seeing the link on Facebook, and I was half kind of thinking, is this a bit of a scam or what? But I went and I gave them all of the details on my idea. They invited me onto the Ideas Academy, and we've done a load of workshops around kind of storytelling, business development, business structures and all that type of thing. And then we got the opportunity to pitch again. So I pitched, and I was an awardee on their Ideas Academy, and they funded the cost of startup and setting up the website and that type of thing. So that's up there now. Alongside that, then they asked me to come on back onto the Action Lab, and again we went through the same process. Now I was kind of thinking about self-sustainability. It's all right getting funding, like, but the funding ends, you know, the project ends if you can't make it self-sustainable. So I was looking at kind of developing a disruptive coffee brand. Now, they didn't run with that because it was a bit of a drift from what I was talking about. So we weren't successful there, but at the same time, we were successful under Kickstart. So we got funding through Kickstart. It was out of the dormant accounts funds. It was probation and Department of Justice funding to do a feasibility study and kind of a commercialization strategy, which is just finished now. And most recently then we got additional funding off Rethink Ireland to develop a companion app for when people leave prison. So then in my head, I would like to see people leaving prison with a free phone that's given to them with the app built in. And they will know where to access services if they get a sudden go on, you're out, because that's usually what happens. There's never any guarantees people can be at the gate to meet somebody. It could be out any day. So at least they'd have this, and they'd be able to find the services that are nearest to them until somebody connects with them.
And as you're speaking there, I'm thinking, okay, a guy gets out of prison, he's struggling, okay, he has this phone, he has an app, okay, maybe on that app there's a group within his area or town or city where there's prisoners from prison previously, have a little group, and they can connect as peers, and they have a little group then maybe once or twice a week, and they talk about the struggles they haven't been integrated back into society. Like, it's a model like GAA, where people with lived experience help those that are under the initial path of recovery.
Yeah,
it sounds like
that's what
something
we're
that could genuinely work.
Yeah, well, like, we are, like, so in my first year, like, since that, I supported people directly. I had planned to do 15. I supported 11 people directly. Only one found their way back to prison, but is back under the wing now, where we're at today now, with about 30 people. And they are learning how to become facilitators and peer mentors. We're developing our own peer mentoring handbook as well.
Is it nationwide?
It is nationwide. So I've people in Cork, I've people in Limerick, people in Sligo, people in Dublin and Galway. There's a few people, Mayo as well. So actually, a good group of us got together there in the Department of Justice last week. We had a meeting with the Department of Justice about their new criminal justice employment strategy, which is targeting people in prison and people on probation to get them job support and job readiness support. So that was a really interesting development, like people that similar backgrounds to myself or whatever were all up in the Department of Justice for a meeting. It was quite an interesting experience. So we are feeding back into that now. We're kind of following up from that meeting. We're kind of working on our own reflections, just to make sure everything, that there's nothing left unsaid, and that all ideas are aired properly. And
I think that's important, that the voices of the people who have lived that experience are the ones that are talking about it in these departments. They're telling the people in the department, what works and what doesn't work, and how to do it and how not to do it. And I think that's very important. And I think you have to give credit to maybe the department for taking stuff like this on board, because these are things that 10 years ago were never happening.
No. And like, if you look into, say, hospitals, care of the patient, it's patient focused, you know. So like, care of people in prison, it should be care of them people and focused on what, like, we had an interesting thing recently where the department actually, for the first time, done a focus group with people in prison, or people that had been in prison, people that are out, and like, we were all part of that actually. And that led to kind of questions around barriers to taking up employment, like whether they were real or you know, self-made.
Do you want to speak to that a bit? Because that's a question me and Timmy get asked every visit we go to about what's the, like, people that they don't really, some people in prison don't have the confidence that when they get out they'll be allowed to move on, they'll be allowed to get jobs and courses and stuff like that.
Well, look, in fairness, like, I was very naive in prison, you know. I believed that I was, if I got all this education, that it would mean something, do you know what I mean? I'd walk out the gate straight into a job. The reality isn't that, like, you get out with a bus pass and a B&B for a night, like, but some of the statistics I've been looking at is where 82% of people believe that their past is going to prevent them from securing opportunities. So if you believe that, you know, you're more than likely you're not going to try. You're not going to try if Garda vetting is a thing. And like I'm saying, that's not the case. Let's look at what you're doing right today. Let's look what your interests are. What are your strengths? What are your qualities? You know, what do you believe you're capable of? And then developing a narrative around that and attaching a value to that, you know, it's really empowering to kind of have them discussions. So yeah, things did happen in our past that we're not very proud of and that we'd like to move on from. But since that time, I've learned this and this from that situation. You know, now I know this, that and the other. And here I am today and I'm applying to your employment because I know I have the skills to carry out the role you've advertised. Let's have a conversation about what I bring rather than what I can't change.
You just need a bit of ambition, don't you? And a bit of support as well.
Yeah, and that's what we offer.
Yeah, yeah. And like, there is opportunities there for people after prison, you know. And you're not a write-off, no matter what you did. And if you've released it, you have an opportunity to move on with your life.
Yeah.
And there's more opportunities than ever because people are more open to employing people with lived convictions and stuff that Senator Lynn Nguyen does in terms of government and policy and the stuff that you do and the stuff that we do and others like us, it all contributes to maybe a shift in perception of people who are in prison because people, you know, myself, some of the people that are in prison have a lot to offer, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, look, in fairness, like I would have relied heavily on people for educational support. You know, they all had plans for the future, getting their families back, you know, being playing a meaningful part in their families' lives, wanting to be somebody, wanting to give back, bags of potential, do you know what I mean? And like, as people that, as I said, relied on heavily for educational support, and then you read about them, then a couple of years down the road, you know, they're dead, they're right back to where they started. Justice didn't prevail there, like, do you know what I mean? So my cause is their cause, do you know what I mean? It has to change. Like,
what is your overall vision? What do you want to see your life succeeding in here? What do you want to happen? And you know that you're after fulfilling the purpose.
Well, if I was to talk about a highlight, let's say, of the last year, a highlight in my life the last year, a guy I've been linking him with, I met him, he was living beside a river. Fast forward 12 months, he's done a shitload of work on himself. Do you know, he's gone, he's taken every opportunity course that has been offered to him. And most recently, I called round to his house and he cooked me dinner. That is stuff.
And you want to see more and more of that.
Yeah, and that was, you know, like I might have opened a door here or there, but he stepped up and walked through it, you know what I mean? And to go around and have him cook me a lovely dinner in his house after recovering from all sorts of chaos and homelessness and all that, that for me is what I enjoy being a part of, a little part of.
I remember the first time we spoke on the first podcast and we spoke about the Garda vetting process. And we had ideas, all of us had similar, near enough similar ideas to how the Garda vetting process should be done instead of the way it is done now.
Yeah.
So we both said that maybe when somebody's out of prison, okay, there's a board that they go in front of, they look at what they have done through education, personal development, how well they're doing now with their counsellor or whatever else, and they look at it as like a little like your parole board, and they say, like, this man, right, he's doing really well, let's put him on the system, as in, like, yeah, he's doing really well, his Garda vetting's there. And when somebody goes about the Garda vetting process, right, the Garda vetting is there from what they have done, but there's also something next to it that says, right, this man has done this in his past, but here is this note, this is what he's done since, you know. So you have this from the past and this from now, from the last 2, 3, 4 years.
Yeah.
You know, instead of the Garda vetting coming up and they see this list of stuff saying he's done this, done that, and this and this. No, these people don't get context of the story of your life previous growing up or why you became addicted to drugs or alcohol, why you got involved in criminality and all other sorts of stuff, okay? All they see is the crimes. But I would love for people to see the good stuff.
Yeah.
Right, he's in recovery. He's helping here, he's helping there, he's involved with this charity. You know, he's done all this work on himself. He's learned that his behaviours from the past weren't doing any, serving him any purpose. But he has also had this stuff happen to him in his life. And this is our psychological evaluation of this is what happens when somebody goes through this as a child.
Well, that is what we're doing. So, like, since the time, so we well, like, in fairness, another piece of stuff that does need to happen, and you'd be talking to ISM, no doubt, the Integrated Sentence Management Program, but and their officers. But when you get inducted into prison, you are told what you can do with your time. Do you know what services are available to you, what training is available to you, education, all them types of things. And you, with the ISM officer, will make a plan on how to use your time well. Then when you come to the end of your sentence, sit down and say, you know, them goals that you set with me in that discussion, did you fulfil them goals? And if you can provide information on fulfilling them goals, then that has a value. But when you look at desistance, like desistance starts from day one outside the gate. You'd have spent years working on yourself in prison to get yourself ready for that.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? And that doesn't even factor into anything. So that is captured. Probation reports are captured. Referrals from, say, sponsors, letters of referral, that type of stuff. Educational attainment, you know, health and well-being, character references, they're all collated into a similar... So, like, if you're going through vetting, you give them all of the addresses you lived at, and all they do is they check is whether or not Damien Quinn had a conviction when he was living here. And that doesn't change. That will never change. But all of this other stuff is changed, and it goes undervalued in a disclosure system. So we collate it the same way, in conjunction with the address check, and we get this other piece of information in and if everybody is satisfied that the benchmarks have been met that they set out themselves, then it's validated and certified up to date. We're not guaranteeing future behavior because nobody can guarantee that. Like this idea of rehabilitation, the only way you can measure that is if somebody never offends again and dies. You know, only then you can say with certainty, Chase, you know what, he was rehabilitated or she was rehabilitated. But by then it will have been too late because they will have struggled right throughout the rest of their lives with conviction disclosures and things they can't change, even though they've changed themselves.
And the disclosures of convictions is something, when somebody has came across it, somebody that's doing well, they've gone into education, they're in recovery, and they get doors closed in their face from interview after interview after interview because of the Garda vetting process. It can be really disheartening, and some people actually give up.
Well, like, if you look at the Act, like, it's there to protect anybody, or protect children and vulnerable adults from anybody that has the capacity to endanger them. But if you went into that block there and you told the lads that's the way they're categorised now, they'd be horrified because a lot of them people would be family men, you know, would have done things out of necessity to put food on the table, do you know what I mean? It's wrong, it's a crime, but it's a necessity, do you know what I mean? But if you were to tell them they were categorised as a risk to children and vulnerable adults, they'd be horrified. So the Act has got skewed. Like, I've seen people going for cleaning jobs, having to go through Garda vetting, working on factory lines, the cameras everywhere, having to go on Garda vetting. Do you know, what does it prove? Like, in my head, employers should really be saying, how having a criminal conviction will impact on their ability to conduct business.
Mm.
And if they can't prove how that is happening, then they shouldn't have it in place.
Because wider society has a role in terms of reducing crime, so that the individual can do what they can do. The Department of Justice, the prison, the probation, at some stage that person has a release date and they're gone from under the justice umbrella. And at that stage, we spoke at an international corrections conference in Porto, and there was a few different countries there. One of them that stood out was Singapore, which has, like, amazing surfaces.
Okay.
It's only a single city state. It's a huge population, but very wealthy. The rates of recidivism the first 2 years after release were very small.
Okay.
But after that, they were very high.
Okay.
And there's a lot of countries like that. But it's like, if you think about it, right, when somebody gets out, let's say they have a suspended sentence, or they're linked in with the Cork Alliance, or Pathways to Change, or the Pathways, and you know, all these other organisations, prison-funded, probation-funded projects. After about 2 years, they're probably not going to be under them anymore.
That's gone, yeah.
And if they're not able to integrate into society through education, employment, the recidivism, the reoffending rates go up after the 2 years,
yeah.
And that's nearly in all jurisdictions.
That's because the crutch is taken out from under your foot,
yeah.
You know. Like,
but the first 2 years after release,
yeah.
The first 12 months, but the first 2 years after release is critical. Mm. If they're not in education or employment or training within that 2 years, then you're out 2 years, you're at the donut list, your life isn't progressing.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, the children are getting old, or you need money, you're under pressure then.
Yeah.
And then you have to provide for your family. And fellas kind of go back to it out of necessity,
yeah.
Or else the pressure of it, and they just fuck it, to go back on the drugs to help you cope with it, because your outlook doesn't look great. The first 2 years are gone, things haven't progressed. So, like, wider society does have a role in reducing crime.
Yeah, well, look, in fairness, if you send people to prison and you treat them like animals in prison, you'll ultimately be letting animals back out onto the street. Nobody wants that. Like, society really needs to have a think about whether or not, do they really want people languishing on the fringes of society, or do they want them to be fully participating members of society? I remember when I used to get into bother, you'd often hear people say, you think you cop on and get himself a job. I'd love a job, but I can't get one. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, society really, really needs to take a deep think about, you know, there's spaces in here for people to really work on themselves, get their heads sorted out, plan for a better future. Do you know what I mean? And really, they should be capturing that desire to change and using it for public good and have people contribute in meaningful ways to society.
100%, and I agree.
Mm.
Okay, I do agree. But I also believe this. I believe nothing as big as what we're talking about changes overnight, okay?
No.
And I believe there is change within the IPS at the moment. And I believe that because if the likes of me and James, ex-prisoners, are left in to do talks in prisons, do podcasts in prisons, no other prisoners going in sharing their lived experience and doing workshops with prisoners, I think that is absolutely massive change. And I think they understand the importance of the lived experience version within the prisons, explaining to the lads, yes, I was like you, but I done this, this, this and that. And no, I have my own little apartment. I have a little car. I never thought I'd drive because I was off the road for 10 years. You know, I have a girlfriend. I'm not drinking or drugging anymore. I go to the gym. I look after myself physically and my mental health. You know, I think we're definitely on the right track.
Mm.
I think we're definitely there.
We are within the justice umbrella.
Yeah.
But it's the people that haven't got an understanding of crime, recidivism, desistance, you know, recovery. All this is they're not in that world. There's a perception, but I suppose why we're doing the podcast, so it reaches people that wouldn't be familiar with this area, and then they might go back into their social circles and they might change perceptions and stuff that around. Maybe people should be allowed to move on with their lives. Maybe they have a lot to offer.
Mm. Yeah, well, look, in fairness, you know, going back to what you said there, like that whole idea of short-term sanctions in the community and being on supervisions and all that stuff, and then that stuff being taken away from you. And like what we're doing with Spiranua, like it's a lifetime friendship. Like we're it's an ongoing assessment model. It's a family. You know, like I get calls. People call amongst each other as well. We've set up kind of peer support for parents as well, so that they can talk about kind of experiences with their children who are caught up in different behaviours as well. Like, and that's taken root now as well. So, but like, short-term sanctions aren't enough. You know, like it takes a little bit of time to get going again, but it can take too long, and people then lose their desire, ambition, determination, and end up going backwards. And that's where the system doesn't work. Do you know what I mean?
Do you know if somebody is in prison and they really want help, the help is there.
Yeah,
and I say that because I wanted help. And it was there for me, and I went about getting it. There was lists, and there was waiting lists. There was massive shortages of psychologists and counsellors, and there was a list. But I kept myself busy by going to the school, right? I had all the services that I needed within the prison at that time. I don't know, like, things have changed a little bit now with COVID and everything, and there's shortages, and I know people are trying to get things going at the moment, and we'll be very honest about it. But when I left prison, I had gotten to be used to, within the prison, had my services, I had a little routine. But when I got home, I was going back into the environment of my past, where I was known as this, that and the other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I was going into a family where I had two young kids and a partner, and my smallest fella didn't even know who I was. My daughter was a little bit lost because it was like I was just taken from the family home 1 minute, and now all of a sudden I'm back after three years. My wife, I'm getting to know her for the first time in my life. We'd been together for about 10 years at this stage, but I was in the height of addiction, you know, and it was very, very, very difficult.
Mm.
And I thought about going back using, okay? Mm. And I actually had to go back to my doctor because I thought I was losing my mind because I was trying to do it. I had meetings, but I just didn't feel better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't feel better about myself. And I found that more difficult than actually being in a prison. Because we are fortunate in Cork that we have the likes of Cork Alliance. So when I had the opportunity to go in there, I was told, yes to me. There's a counsellor here for you. Come in here once a week. I got that done. They helped with the education and stuff. But we don't have that everywhere. You know, we don't. And I think,
like, if you're getting released from here and you live locally, there's not a whole lot up this side of the world.
No, it's a bit remote, all that.
It's like that in other places. If fellas are going back to rural Ireland, if you're going back to Limerick, Cork, Galway, maybe, to a lesser extent, Dublin, definitely, you're okay. There's a lot there. If you're going back to Leitrim, Cavan, Kerry,
in fairness, Galway, there wouldn't have been much there now when I was getting out. It's interesting hearing you talk about kind of going back to home, because I made a detrimental mistake when I was getting out. I could get out anywhere. I was getting out into homelessness. So I caught the map of Ireland, threw a pen at it, hit Athlone, and I said, I'll go there. But you know what?
That was a good shot, because that's right in the middle.
So, but you see, my re-entry plan changed. What happened for me was I was meant to be getting out into rehab, into Harrison House. The funding was withdrew. Now it's open again, but funding was withdrew at the time, so my re-entry plan changed. So,
but you know, there should be something. My point is here, right? My point is there should be a structure.
Mm.
If we have people in prison, we're trying to rehabilitate them and get them to be a part of society. Prison is probably 30% of it. The next 70% is when they get out. They're going back into the environment they left, where they were involved in stuff, and the family at home are probably caught up in addiction, and there might be violence and criminality.
Mm.
Like, what needs to be set up, in my opinion, is maybe something separately where they don't have to go back to the natural environment.
Transitional.
They don't have to go there. They can go here, where there's other lads trying to get themselves away from that life as well.
Yeah.
You know, where there's a counsellor that will still work with them once a week.
Yeah.
These are things,
like an aftercare house, or what you get from treatment.
Yeah.
But you know what's the problem we spoke about there? Kind of throwing the dart on the map and I go there.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was working in a homeless hostel in Cork City, occasionally you get fellas coming that that's just after getting released from Cork prison, but they're not from Cork.
Yeah.
Now, when you're not from the place you can't get homeless services. Like, you can get a sleeping bag, you can get the real emergency, but you have to register as homeless with the city council. If you're not from Cork City, you can't register as homeless. Mm. Can't get social welfare. They send you back to your place of interest.
Mm.
Now, for a lot of fellas and girls, they either can't go home because they're in danger, or they don't want to go home because of all the triggers or whatever.
Yeah.
But they end up on the street begging or robbing and stuff like that because there's no services. So that centre of interest policy is very damaging for people that look for a new start elsewhere, you know?
Yeah. But that was my point. Like, so I went to somewhere for a new start, thinking, do you know what, I'll stay away from where I'm from, I'll get myself together, I'll come home when life is good, you know, and play a part in their lives. But I wasn't accountable to anybody where I went in Athlone, you know. And when things weren't working out, then I found myself slipping back into old habits and getting myself into trouble. And within no length of time, when things weren't working out, I was right back to where I started, running from everybody. I had to leave the country and seriously caught up in a lot of stuff. And but you know, when I actually came around and got over all that went on and got home to where I knew people that I cared about, there was a level of accountability there, because I didn't want to put anybody that mattered to me through any of the shit again. And that was kind of the start. Like, so if I had my time over again, I would have gone straight home. Like, I have very good friends that are still caught up doing what they're doing. They respect me enough not to do anything around me, and I respect them enough and love them enough not to expect them to change, you know what I mean? I made the decision that I wanted to change. Like, you can run as far and as fast as you like, but you'll never run away from yourself, do you know what I mean? I learned that the hard way. But when I got home, around the people that mattered, and it wasn't easy, I couldn't get work, I couldn't get anything, but I was accountable. I had that level of responsibility to not want to put anybody through any shit again. And then I started a bit of self-care, long walks, a bit of fitness, then found a course. Well, I found my partner, found a course, found a job by accident through a friend. But through all the normal channels of applying for these things, the barriers just kept shooting up, do you know what I mean? But when I actually stopped looking and found a few bits and pieces where there was no barriers, things started to improve. So, but like, that whole journey should have been easier, like, for somebody that was really, really trying to get as much as they can and plan for a better future inside. There should have been a bit of continuity there.
What's your vision or forecast for the next 2 years?
There's a really interesting, I'm pushing for, I don't know if you ever heard of Grow Remote. Have you heard of that organisation? So they reckon they've got 80,000 online jobs in prison, in the community. And you don't need Garda Veton to work in your own sitting room, do you know what I mean? You're not around people. So I believe there is a pathway there. The short 12-week courses, free of charge. I spoke to Grow Remote a number of times, and I would love to start bringing that training into the Irish prison system. Now, I know there's issues around internet access, but there's also software you can get and permissions and all that type of thing. But like, it's a 12-week program. I remember when I was here, I was learning how to use computers and all that type of thing. Good jobs, entry-level jobs. And then you literally know how to do the job, you're leaving with them skills. And you can just open a laptop anywhere and start working and start moving on. That would be, yeah, we're looking, like, the education and training is great, don't get me wrong. ETB does all these interesting courses or whatever.
I would like to see something like that work inside maybe a facility, an office, instead of people at home, because you still have the, particularly people that are coming from prison, you still have that kind of thing that they're stuck at home, and that little bit of boredom thing. I think maybe if there was a setting
there is, you do get
where I'm coming from, because I wouldn't like to know that I'd be sitting at home on a laptop for a certain amount of time my game.
Why should I not?
It does, like, in fairness, like, my office is my laptop, do you know what I mean? And I get a lot of work done on my laptop, but like, with Grow Remote, they have remote working chapters where they meet up on a Friday, they go and have a cup of coffee, chat about work, but it's informal, and you know, you don't have to go through, in my head, you don't have to go through Garda Veton to do that. And we've had them discussions, and I've spoke to them about bringing the program into prison, and they're wide open to it. All we need is IPS to kind of say.
And what kind of jobs is it? Is it selling, marketing? Is it selling online stuff?
Yeah, computer programming, all that types of things. You know, anything to do with a computer. It's all remote working.
Sounds interesting.
It is, and like, it's good pay as well, and all that. And you get holidays the same way as in ordinary employment. You know, bank holidays. All that type of thing. And like, the it opens up a whole new world to people. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So what is it about? So Damien, what tell us about the probation journal. I see something on Twitter there recently with Katrina Swarak from UCC.
Yeah, so Katrina has always been kind of a supporter of the project. So I would have actually quoted her in my research, but she contacted me on Twitter one day and she said, would you be interested in doing an article on your project? So I said, yeah. I didn't think it would get published or anything, but we submitted an article to them, and it's actually going into the 30-year anniversary probation journal this year, and it covers the whole Spiranua project, the process, the delabeling, the legal delabeling of people with convictions, and providing a passport to support people as they seek opportunity. But it also gives readers and people offering opportunity that little bit of reassurance when they knowingly offer an opportunity to people with convictions.
Is that published now? Can listeners go and read that now?
It's coming. It'll be the journal isn't published yet. It's gone to print, but it'll be out now soon. And that is a big deal.
Yes.
Considering where we've come from, and
we would actually stick this podcast out when it's released, and we can link the article in the description so people can follow on afterwards.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm sure they can check us out on the website, anyways. www.spiranua.org. So check us out there, and anyways, I can be of any help to anybody, I'm all in, because this stuff matters to me.
I know James knows it, and we just want to wish you absolutely going forward the best of everything.
Likewise,
I'm sure somebody is going to jump in at an opportunity to help you financially, because they'll see the complete benefit of this project, not just in Galway and around the Midwest.
Beyond.
I mean everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah. That's the plan.
Maybe even beyond. So the best of luck.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The Toonaries podcast is proudly sponsored by Inline Eco, your trusted partner in asbestos removal and re-roofing services across Ireland. Your peace of mind and safety are our top priorities. For more information, visit inlineeco.ie.
Hello everybody, and welcome back to the Toonaries podcast. We are up in Lochan House, isn't that right, Tim?
Yes, I can.
We're doing a kind of a project, really, is what you could call it, and the prison. It's an open prison, it's a unique place, and I have to forget your name again.
Angela Dennehy.
And we are going to interview Angela Dennehy, and you're the head teacher in the education unit here in the prison.
Yep, that's it.
Now, we've been to all the prisons in Ireland at this stage. I've never seen an education unit that big.
Yeah.
It's like an actual school, isn't it?
It is. It's not like a prison at all. I used to work in a closed prison down in Castlereagh, and the difference is amazing. When you walk into the building, it's just so airy and light, so it is. It's like a normal school. There's no bars, there's no kind of grey or kind of bleakness to it that can be in some of the closed prisons. So it's a lovely school. It's a really nice environment.
Is that funded by CAV and ETB?
Yeah, CAV and ETB were funded by. There's 9 teachers in the school and myself.
And what kind of programmes are you running over there?
Well, for 9 teachers, we run a wide range of programmes. Some are quite similar to all of the other prison schools. We'd have English, maths, computers, all of the kind of the basic subjects. More specifically then, we have a craft room, so a room dedicated to textiles and sewing, where people can make craft goods or they can make toys for the kids. We have a ceramics or pottery room. Again, people can make things for their kids there, or things for their, artifacts for their houses and stuff like that. We have woodwork, we've got cooking. Other things that we have that may not be in the wouldn't be in the closed centres is we have our own polytunnel. I don't know if you saw that, it's outside the car wash, and we have our own little horticulture classroom outside, so the men can learn how to grow their own fruit and veg there, and we can use that fruit and veg then in the cooking class, so we do.
What about Open University? Have you got that here?
We do, we've Open University as
so
well.
If someone was coming from, say, a main prison, would they be able to continue the course in Open University?
Absolutely,
here?
Yeah, absolutely. They can continue it on. And we've great links with all of the other prison schools. We're always in contact with each other, all of the head teachers. Mm. So we've no problem passing work around from, one prison to the other.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Also, if someone was doing, for example, because of nine teachers, even though we have a wide spread of subjects, we can't offer everything. So we might not have business studies, for example, or psychology. But if someone comes up and they were doing their QQI in another jail, what they can do is they can finish it off generally with the teacher in the other jail. Yeah. Almost do a correspondence course so they can get their subject finished.
What about, say, if you have somebody in a main prison, okay, and they're doing an apprenticeship on the outside,
yeah,
and they finished phase two and done phase three, and they're up here and they wanted to maybe do phase four in one of the ITs. Mm-hmm. Has that happened before? Is something like that possible?
Not in my time. Now, I'm only here 4 years, yeah. So a lot of my time, unfortunately, has been marred a little bit by COVID. So, you know, there was a lot of restrictions, obviously. We do have two in that position at the moment. And one is they do run the phase that he wants to do in Sligo. We have great links with Mayo Sligo ETB. There's a direct bus outside the jail from here over to Sligo. So at the moment, we're in the process, I'm working on him getting to up there to do his next phase with the ETB in Sligo.
That's great.
But we've no confirmation yet what that'll happen.
The Open University and ETB is separate. Mm-hmm. So how does it work if somebody is doing an Open University course? Do the ETB tutors facilitate that, or do they help them as like an add-on? Or what's the partnership like?
So it'd be the computer teacher, Jenny, would facilitate it with us, and obviously another subject teacher could facilitate it if it's a subject, you know, the same subject area. Well, they've very good internet access here, so anyone that comes up automatically gets internet access, so they do. So they're able to access all of their modules online. It's very easy for us to organise tutorials with their tutor as well, because we don't have the same restrictions. So say, for example, the school here is open all day, every day. All the men have to do is cross the car park over from their accommodation block to get to the school. So, which is great for us. It makes it very easy to arrange things like that. You're not dependent on getting someone up from a particular landing or dependent on officers being available if you know the prisons are short staffed or anything like that. So if we make a plan, generally we can stick to it. Men also have their own phones here as well. So that makes it very useful. If the OU tutor is willing, they can ring the men directly on their own phones, you know, at an arranged time.
And you know, if somebody's doing an Open University course and they needed support with essay writing or the literacy, or they might have dyslexia and stuff like that, is the support available for them?
There are, yeah. We have a literacy programme here that we run, so the English teacher here, Katrina, she will be able to help them with that.
Excellent.
That was actually going to be my question I was going to ask you. How do you work with people with different learning differences and people who may struggle with reading and writing, you know, because there are a lot of people within the main prison population who can't read and write, and they would like to read and write. And I have seen some teachers along my own way really bring the pace of teaching down to the level of the person they're teaching with dyslexia, dyspraxia, ADHD, you know, just so they can get a nice experience, something completely different to what they were what they experienced inside in school.
Yeah.
You know? So do you understand the whole kind of... I'm obviously thinking you do, because you look like somebody that gets it. You do understand the importance of that level of kind of communication and just really taking your time.
Absolutely. The prison teachers, they really are an amazing bunch of teachers in the wider education system. They're so adaptive, so they are, and they're so good at reacting to, you know, different levels and abilities in the classroom and any additional education needs that people may have. We've two teachers who specifically deal with adult basic education, so that would be numeracy, digital literacy, as well as English literacy. So between the two of them, they can cover most things. Again, we're very lucky, we can get a lot of support if needed from the ETB as well, if we needed someone to come in with a particular specialism to help the teachers with some training, or, you know, if we came across something that we hadn't have dealt with before. But no, in general, the teachers are very well equipped to be able to deal with that, and they can, you know, they'll all change their lessons accordingly. We have enough time to do one-to-one teaching here as well with any literacy students, if they prefer to do one-to-one reading and writing classes. And again, we're so lucky where we've no restrictions. So if a teacher sets a time for the guy to come tomorrow, he'll be able to come.
What do you enjoy about working here in this place?
I enjoy getting to know the men in a different level. It's just so much more relaxed than the closed jails. So you do get to know the men in a different way. Even coming across here in the car park now, I met Damien Quinn. I believe you were talking to Damien earlier. Damien is past people of mine from Castlereagh and that. And I hadn't seen Damien in 14 years. You know, so it's amazing to see him and see how well he's been doing since. He is absolutely flying.
Some great work as well for the people.
He is, absolutely. Now I'm going to drop him an email when I get back to my desk and see, can we kind of forge some links there as well to get him to come in. So seeing men progress as well. And that. So recently we just ran for the first time here a HGV lorry driving learner permit course. So it's just to get the men as far as having their CPC card and get their learner permit so they can start the lorry driving lessons. So we had 12 start the course. Unfortunately, two had to pull out. But we 10 just finish it. And it's great to see them looking up courses now, because at the moment, Sullis with the ETBs are running a huge amount of free lorry driving courses around the country. So they are. And to get on the course, you need your permit and your CPC card.
So you do the CF pass as well, and manual handling.
Yep, they're on as well. The work training do organise them, so they do. So Mr Kelly here with the ISM officer, he organises them courses.
They're a big deal for some of the lads going out. You know,
absolutely.
Just to have those. Because if you have the CF pass and the manual handling, you can walk straight into a job, because there's so much construction work at the moment.
Exactly, absolutely. And it's great to see the men achieve that and hopefully see them.
You want to add?
There's a couple of other small things that we do. First of all, we have a band. We have the Lochan House Band. I hope you get to see them play later. We're always looking for drummers. So anyone out there looking at this, if they're a drummer, we'd love to see you come up here. We also run what's unique to Lochan is an outdoor pursuits program as well. So the men can go out on hill walks. Generally, they can go out once a fortnight on hill walks. And the teacher also brings them out surfing. So he does in the summer at the end of the year. And we're trying to forge more and more links with Sligo. So we are with both the Sligo IT and the Sligo ETB to try and get more men out to do courses as well on the outside.
What about personal development and also physical education? Do you have anything within the school for both personal development and physical?
Yeah, physical education. We have a huge gym. I don't know if you've gotten a chance to see that.
We'll have a look at it.
No, it's really big. Yeah, and our teacher is great. He runs, he does football training. So he does a boot camp every morning, which is almost like circuit training. That's a really popular class. So only there a few weeks ago, he got his football team from the outside to come in. That's the second time this year he got a football team from the outside to come in. I think they bet them again, Pat, and they. So twice now we've Lochan House have bet the teams from Donegal and Fermanagh. So the men really, really enjoy that, so they do. And that.
Do you know, in nearly all the other prisons, if you're talking to the education people, there's challenges with lack of officers and detail and space and rooms. Yeah. What challenges do you face up here, or if any?
The challenge we would face from our, it's more of a challenge for us maybe than for them, but it is a challenge for the men as well, is when they start to get temporary release. So it's great to see people get temporary release, it really is. So they'll start off maybe getting out once a month for three nights at a time, and that can go on up to twice a month. But that can obviously interfere then with the routine. You know, the more often people are getting out on temporary lease, the more their head is always conflicted. You know, it's conflicted between home and to being here as well.
To come back as well.
Exactly. It is hard to see them come. You know, they can be a bit fed up when they come back. They're like sometimes, they're like ourselves, maybe in the middle of November on a Monday morning coming to work, they're a bit fed up coming back, so they are.
Or you go away on the holidays or you leave for a few days and you're back and work on the
Monday
morning.
Exactly. So, yeah. So that can be a challenge for us, especially if you want to run group projects. So we have to be very careful if we're running group projects that we can get a group that will be, you know, that will be there. But having said that, we're so used to people coming and going even during the day. Like you'd get men here up to the school who come up from the kitchen. So they come up in their whites for, they come up for an hour in the morning and maybe an hour in the afternoon. And that really wouldn't be possible in the closed prisons because it's just so hard to physically move around the place and that. So
yeah, do you know some of the feedback we've gotten in other prisons was... And one of the prisoners put it very succinctly to me. He'd be saying, if you go up to the school, this was in, I won't name the prison. If you go up to the school and you want to do woodwork, there's a woodwork shop. Mm-hmm. And if you want to do English, there's English class. And if you want to do crafts, there's crafts and art and that. He said, but if you're in recovery and you, or you want to do the work on yourself, mm-hmm. there's nowhere for us. Do you ever think that like that there'd be a specific programme, maybe a recovery programme, not just for addiction, but as Timmy was touching on, the personal development space, the life skills, the mental health, emotional intelligence, well-being. Do you think that there's a role? Would that be separate from psychology? Would it be psychology? Would it be education? Would it be both? Or would you like to see something like that?
Absolutely. And it is an area I think that needs to be worked on. Here we have a psychologist now. Gerard started about 4 months ago. So again, the school have already started to build good links with Gerard. I know he's getting involved in our parenting course, so he has. We also had the Mental Health Week this year and the Amber Flag Week, and the Red Cross have been great in running overdose prevention facilitation courses as well. But there is definitely a lot of room for improvement there in that area,
which
we would work with psychology and that. I know Gerard has started his own course as well, which has been going very, very well.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to seeing the school in a minute.
Great.
And I'm sure we'll document that and people can see it.
Perfect. Thanks nice to meet you guys. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
The Toonaries podcast is proudly sponsored by Inline Eco, your trusted partner in asbestos removal and re-roofing services across Ireland. Your peace of mind and safety are our top priorities. For more information, visit inlineeco.ie.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Toonaries podcast. We're here with my good friend Timmy Long, as always.
Hi, everyone.
Nearly skipped you there, Timmy.
No, when I'm doing this the opposite way, I completely, you know what happens? I get nervous and I forget this here.
You know what you says once or twice. Hello, everybody. I am your co-host.
I get caught up, I'm not used to doing the introduction. But
anything out of the routine can be all fucked up. But anyway, we're up in Lochan House. It's part of our little thing that we're doing at the moment up here. And we've a guest here, a prisoner. This will be anonymous.
Thank you.
Because we don't want people Googling and making judgments. So people hear the human side or the story of maybe somebody that's inside. So we protect your identity, and thanks for putting yourself forward for this.
No problem.
Will you set the context for us of where you grew up, what life was like before you came here?
Yeah, I grew up in Limerick City. I'm 54 now, so I grew up, my childhood was late 70s, early 80s, I suppose, and I had a good childhood, you know. I suppose what you consider to be a normal childhood. You know, I went to school, I played sports.
Kind of sports.
From Limerick, so I had to play rugby.
Yeah.
Played hurling, played soccer, played them all. Wasn't much good at any of them, but I played them all, you know. Just like I said, I had happy memories of it.
Were you academic? Were you a smart kid?
Yeah, I suppose I would have been, yeah. Mm. Well, reasonably, yeah.
Mm. Did you do well in school?
Yeah, I did, yeah. I had a degree in business studies before I came in here, but I qualified in 1991 with that.
And were you working in business?
I was, yeah. I worked in Dublin for over 25 years.
What kind of a sector were you working in?
I worked with a kind of semi-state institute, Department of Transport.
Oh, and how did it all go wrong for you?
Gambling. It's the only thing that's put me here. Mm. It's the only form of a criminal conviction that I'd have apart from minor motoring offences or whatever. All my convictions are gambling related.
So, right, gambling became an addiction for you. As can you bring us back a little bit to when it actually started, or when was the even first time that you gambled?
I can remember going to a bookies when I was very small, when I was about 11 or 12, to put on a bet for my father. Now, my father had absolutely no gambling issues whatsoever. This was like a 20 pence bet he used to do every Saturday for fun. But I remember one day he sent me to a bookies and I had to do a bet for him. And there was something about the place, I think, that kind of I liked. I grew up, like when I say I had a happy childhood, I did. But I grew up with red hair, freckles and glasses. Mm. You know, and
that brings issues.
Huh? It does, yeah. You know, I mean... In context, like actually, they're small, pissy small, issues. When you're a kid, they're not small, you know, when you're getting constantly ragged and bullied and picked on because you have red hair and glasses. And when I went into bookies, I remember it was all full of outfellas. What I consider to be outfellas, like, you know, smoking and patting me in the head, and none of them were judging me, none of them were slagging me.
The boy rowing the air.
Yeah.
Walking around.
Yeah. And none of them were slagging me about the red hair, none of them were slagging me about the glasses. And I go, just listen to it.
Mm.
And I remember I did my first bet properly, I think, when I was about 15. And it all went wrong very quickly after that for me, you know.
Was it dogs, horses, football?
At the start, it was horses and dogs, yeah. And the biggest problem I had was, like most compulsive gamblers will tell you, I had a big win.
Mm-hmm.
The worst thing that could happen.
Yeah, I remember it. A 50 pence bet in 1984 that I won £51 off of. £51 in 1984 was a...
For young fella.
A decent penny, you know, and like you're going back to a day where it was 40 pence for a pint, you know. So that was it then for me, pretty much. After that kind of decided for me that was how I was going to make my living. I was going to get rich quick.
How would your money come from back then in relation to gambling? Were you working?
I would have cut school a couple of afternoons a week and worked, and I would have worked a weekend job advertising in a newspaper when I was like 15, 16.
Mm.
I always had a mind that was...
So your money was held on?
Initially it was, after that it became stolen.
Yeah.
You know?
We'll get into that. So
yeah.
How did it gradually get to where it was?
Got to a point fairly quickly with me. I remember... By the age of 18, 19, I was kind of trying to study and I was trying to work, and it just, I think my personality just was the type of fella that wanted it all and wanted it now, and I found the gambling was a release from other kind of pressures that I might have had, and there was also the financial element of it, and it just kept me totally preoccupied. It got to the stage where I very quickly wasn't earning enough money. You know, if I was, I was losing it. You know, quite literally, the minute I'd get paid, I'd have it blown in half an hour sometimes. Then there'd be the odd time, the 1 in 10 time that you'd win. You know, when you're just about to give it up, it pulls you back in.
Yeah.
But even when I was winning, it wasn't enough then, because the stakes just kept getting higher and higher and higher very quickly.
Mm. It's insidious.
Oh, completely.
Yeah, I'm a compulsive gambler myself, and we had a conversation previously about it.
Yeah.
And I know exactly what you're saying. You know, there's absolutely no control over it. Once there's money inside in the pocket, or there's money somewhere else where you can get it, you will continue gambling until there's nothing there.
Yeah.
When you say you started stealing for the money then, talk to us a little bit about that.
Would have started at home, I suppose, you know. Stealing money from the father's wallet or the mother's purse or the sister if she had money hidden upstairs. That's where it would have started when I was younger. After that, I remember once I stole from a neighbour. I actually stole from an next-door neighbour. And that was one of my first ever criminal convictions because they rang the guard.
When you said that there, I felt even today like a little bit of shame, remorse, regret.
In the world, there's more than a little bit, you know.
Yeah. But that's what people do. You don't understand. I'm sure you understand that. No, that's what people do.
Yeah. And it just got worse. you know, it got worse. And for me, it was okay then, because I was able to justify it to myself as I went along, because while I stole from a neighbour when I was very young, I was 17 or 18 when I did that. After that, the older I got, I'd consciously make a decision that I'd only steal money from businesses or companies or con money out of businesses and things like that, because in my mind I was able to justify it, that I'm not robbing an individual that you're there insure. I was always able to just, like any addict, I could justify everything to myself very easily to continue what I was doing, you know.
How did it come to a head for you?
Oh, Jesus, court appearances, I suppose. But like I said, you know, I was 51 when I got locked up on these charges, and the first time I was in court I was 19. And I avoided jail between the ages of 19 and 51, you know. So
do you know the way a drug addict has, they hit a rock bottom?
Mm.
What were the different things that happened in your life that could have been your rock bottom, but they weren't? No, obviously, you're in recovery now.
Yeah.
We're from gambling addiction. But there was, like, I can remember and recall so many different times that my life was in danger, that I could have died from drug overdose, that I could have killed myself in a car, or I fell here, or I could have murdered, or whatever it may have been. There are so many things that I only can see them now because I'm at the other end. Looking back at all the different things that happened then, what were the different things that happened in your life that a normal person would have stopped, maybe, if that just happened back then?
I don't know, I suppose. The guards appearing on my mother's doorstep, for starters, would have been a constant reminder of what I was doing. And I either, at the time, I either don't know, but I either didn't care or couldn't stop. Maybe it was a combination of both. But for me, like I said, I just became very immune to the whole process. The worse it got, I knew it was getting worse, but I actually didn't care. I mean, I went into treatment for the first time in 1991 in Bushy Park in Ennis. I was the first gambler in the door of a treatment centre in Ireland at that time, or in Bushy Park anyway, and I was only 22 years of age. And I didn't have a bet for 12 years. 12 years. Because I did what I was told, I did what I was advised, I went to my meetings, and I lived a relatively normal life, you know. And then things started to go wrong. I became complacent. I had a really good job.
Can I just bring you back? It's crushing out there. So you're away from gambling for 12 years.
Yeah.
Just explain to people how fast you went back. Like, what were the different things that were happening in your life? What did you stop doing that you were doing all the time to keep yourself absent from gambling? So, do you know the way a drug addict, they start thinking about taking drugs? Right, if I'm in recovery, I start thinking beforehand, I keep it to myself instead of telling one of the lads or James or Sean, boys, I'm thinking about drugs a lot there at the moment instead of grassing myself up, but I'm internalising it because I want to keep that thought to myself. And I eventually go and use and I relapse. What was going on for you in the lead up to your actual going back gambling? How long did it take? What was playing on in your life and what was going on in your head?
I suppose I got very complacent, I suppose. For me, like I said, I had about 10 years, I was about 10 years into the whole recovery thing, where I had started to stop going to as many meetings as I did. I used to go to 3 to 4 meetings a week religiously in Dublin, and then that was going down to maybe 2, sometimes it was going down to 1. Stopped taking phone calls from my sponsor. Basically what happened to me was I began to think I knew it all, and that I had it beaten, and that I could control it. And it just got the better of me again, eventually. But I can honestly say it was probably building up for about a year or two that I knew I was going to go back gambling. I knew I was going to do it. It was only a matter of when.
Mm.
You know? And
the cunning side of that, you knew that this was happening, but the strength, like, the addiction is already there in your bones 12 months before you actually had to gamble.
Yeah.
Because the strength and the willpower just to keep that sentence that, oh lads, I'm thinking about going back out gambling, from everybody else.
I could never do that because, and you'll probably identify with this as a gambler yourself, huge amount of pride going on with me, and there was a huge amount of ego.
Yeah.
And I automatically thought that I was a lot cleverer than everyone else and that nobody will know what I'm doing. Because I'm not falling around the place drunk, or I'm not walking around the place with my eyeballs hanging out of my head, they won't know if I'm gambling or not. You know, I can... I just built up a whole wall of secrecy. Because I did everything by myself. Like, I never committed a crime with anybody in my life. Everything I did by myself, for myself, and thought I was keeping everything under the radar.
Mm.
You know, like, to this day, I have five friends. Five. We've been best friends for over 35 years. They knew all the time what I was doing. They knew all the time what I was like. They tried to help me. But I used to think that I was pulling the wool over their eyes as well. And I wasn't. The only person I ever fooled, ever, was myself. You know? And just on the... Like, I remember when I stopped gambling around 1991, my smallest bet, or my biggest bet, probably would have been in around a £20 mark. Mm. 20 quid a bet. My first bet when I came out, when I went back gambling in 2003 that time, was £250 win. You know, I always remember an addiction counsellor telling me that this is a disease that's grown inside you. It's not going to go away ever, and it's going to keep growing and growing and growing. And that was proven by the volume and the size. Because when I went back gambling that time, it wasn't just one bet here and one bet there. I went fucking nuts.
Yeah, it took off really fast. You know, because nuts. Like, some people, when they go back out in addiction with alcohol and drugs, some people might start off drinking and they have two bottles here. You know, that could never be me anyway. I'll just from that. But with gambling, it's the chase.
Mm.
You lose 200, you're chasing that 200. Mm. There's no stop. Mm. You're always chasing. Mm. It's like drugs, you're chasing the next high. But with gambling, you're always trying to make back the money. And you could be 100,000 in debt. No one giving you money. But you'll find money to go away and see, can you win that money back with the intention of paying everybody back?
Absolutely.
The intention of doing good is there.
Oh, it is.
But it just, it never worked out.
Yeah.
You know, it, how did it escalate from there then?
I spent 2003 right up to 2010 gambling, but I could sustain it. I had a really good job. You know, I was very well paid. I developed a big network of clients, customers, things like that. People that I could always have access. I could always have ready access to money if I needed it. And even that wasn't enough. I was bleeding wells dry quicker than you could blink. And the more intense the gambling became, the more risks I was taking then with regard to scams and things like that that I was coming up with to finance the gambling. But again, in the back of my mind, I'd been in court at this stage. Prior to 1991, I was in court a few times. Between 2003 and 2010, I would have been in court several times. All different small charges in different district courts around the country.
What kind of charges?
Fraud.
Do you know what I'm thinking of? You know, do you know, let's say if you're in a drug addiction and you're going into court over a period of time, you're going to end up in prison. A lot faster, but you know, with white collar crime like that, fraud like that, there's a lot more leniency given, and that's, I suppose.
There was then, I don't think there is as much now, but and with me as well, there was a lot of cuteness involved.
Mm.
Like, I would go to court 9 times out of 10 when I would have went into court. If I robbed you for 500 quid, I'd have that 500 quid paid back to you before I went into court.
Yeah.
Now, I'd have had to rob you to pay him back,
yeah.
But I was paying you back. So when I went into court, the judge was saying, "Ah, sure, he's paid him back. There's no one." And I was getting suspended sentence after.
There's a lot of manipulation going on.
Of course there was.
Did you ever hear of Tony O'Reilly?
I've met Tony, yeah.
Yeah, mad story. I suppose you could identify, he was working in a post office.
That's right.
Nearly $2 million cash into Paddy Power.
Yeah.
But if you're in that position, you would have done the same.
Oh, it's irrelevant how much money you have.
Yeah. If you're in a position to access funds, even if they're not yours, You're going to do it.
I remember in that period, I had become numb from the whole thing. And I remember, like, I could walk out of work on a Friday earning $3,000 a week with commissions and bonuses and all other things that I had put into it. I could walk out with $3,000 in my pocket at 5 o'clock, and by 7 o'clock I could have nothing.
Gone.
Or I could have $20,000 or $30,000.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd gotten to a point where if I had the $20,000 or $30,000, I didn't care. If I had nothing, I didn't care. It took all emotion from me. But I do remember one day I left work on a Wednesday evening and I had £3 in my pocket. £3. And I went into bookies and I turned the £3 into 20. And I came out ecstatic, delighted, because I had £20 that I could feed myself. So there's complete insanity. Like anybody that doesn't understand gambling.
Yeah. But eventually you ended up in prison.
Yeah.
So what's it like for an educated man with a good job and a good salary? Like, what was it like coming into prison? Culture shock. What was your experience?
Yeah, it was a big, big culture shock for me.
Did you go into Limerick prison?
I went to Limerick to be committed, but I only spent the COVID quarantine period in Limerick, and they had to move me because I was morbidly obese going into prison. I was 28 and a half stone. Like I couldn't walk 50 yards yet, and I couldn't climb a flight of stairs. So they needed to put me in a prison with a ground floor, so they sent me to Portlaoise, which was great.
What way do you know?
16, 10.
Yeah, fucking hell, I can't imagine you that size.
Oh, yeah.
No, we don't want to know the details of your crimes or anything like that. That's not what we're here for. But where did this all take you mentally towards the end? Like how bad did it get? Like, how bad were the things that you were doing? How far did it bring you? And like, do you know the way I look back at some of the things I've done, when I've, like, you feel shame, you feel regret and guilt. You know, and you said, jeez, I've done things that I thought I'd never do. But were you brought to that place as well in your own life? And did it bring you to a place that you said, like, this is not who I am at all? I have to look at this.
I always thought that. But I couldn't get a grip on it. And I only got a grip of it when I came into prison, with the help I got in Portlaoise off of a lady. I'll talk about her in a while. But I always had it in the back of my head that I was too smart. I was too clever to go to prison. I was always going to beat it. I was always able to stay ahead of the system, blah, 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 blah. That's the way I operated. Arrogance, ego, call it what you want. But going into prison was a culture shock. With me then, you see, the crimes, they were getting bigger financially to a degree, but none of them were huge. Like, and again, I could have done an awful lot more damage than I did. But the reason I didn't was deliberate, insofar as I reckoned if I kept them all fairly low, I'd stay out of prison.
Yeah.
But I knew that it was an inevitability with the amount of them. Like, I had to end up in prison. I had no choice.
Yeah, it's coming down.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I had guards telling me that for years in Limerick.
What was it like when you got sentenced? The next closed in.
Again, I knew it was coming. And I'd kind of resign myself to it, but it's still very different when you have to go in there. I don't know if you've been in Limerick prison, like, but it's
we were in there, yeah.
It's not a very nice place to go, you know. Of all the prisons, and I've been in a fair few of them on the sentence. Like,
Cork prison would have been probably the nearest to Limerick prison, I'd say.
Cork. I've been in Cork on remand because I was going to court. And
the old one.
Yeah, I was in the old one years ago. Yeah.
As we're talking here, I think it's important to bring you back one step. Okay, you were 28 stone stopping. Okay.
Yeah.
Your mental health was completely destroyed. You were definitely overeating. To be able to soothe yourself.
Yeah.
No, you were gambling and you were overeating as well.
Yeah.
So you were cross addicted. And you're obviously soothing yourself every time you have a knockdown with the gambling, with food.
Food.
No matter what you win or lose, it doesn't matter. That addiction is there as well. Yeah. Did you have to get help with the food addiction as well?
I did, indirectly, not the way I should have done.
Yeah.
I collapsed one night in Portlaoise. Didn't know what happened to me. I woke up with four officers around me. I was in the shower. And they brought me to the doctor, and the doctor told me I had type 2 diabetes, and basically if I didn't cop myself on, I had about 6 months to live.
And since then you're down 12 stone?
Since then I'm down 12 stone, yeah.
Okay, man. And what's life like now? Obviously we're up in Locking House.
That's fantastic. For someone that's in jail to say his life is fantastic, but it is, because
I can understand that.
I've no worry. My only worry today concerns my mother. She's at home on her own with dementia, and that's something I feel hugely, hugely bad about, that I've left her in that position. But that's just something I've had to deal with. But that aside, my life is as good as it's ever been, to be honest with you.
Do you think if you didn't go to prison, did you stop gambling before you came to prison, or was it something you had to stop the day before you came into prison?
I was walking to court to be sentenced on the 14th of October 2020 in the pissing rain, and I was walking up William Street in Limerick with a kit bag in one hand, my pyjamas and my tracksuits in it, and I was gambling on my phone in the other hand on my way to being sentenced.
So it was something that happened. You got into your own when you came into prison, you started to understand that you had a gambling addiction. Well, you obviously knew that.
Oh, I knew, I knew, but...
Yeah, but you got the help inside in prison.
Do you know, I did. Yeah, I worked with a lady in Port Leash called Nolene.
Yeah.
Nolene Clancy Kelly, she's a counsellor down there. And, yeah, that and education. Counselling, education and help from the chaplaincy services in all the prisons I've been in have been what have done it for me.
And that's very important to mention, because of there's a massive kind of shortages within the prison system at the moment. Across the board, we can't get, and it's the same on the outside. But you obviously got the help you needed.
Yeah.
There was probably a waiting list.
I was very lucky.
Yeah.
Insofar as I got my barrister to ask the judge to insist that I got it.
Yeah.
And the judge made it part of my order.
Yeah.
So therefore, I suppose they looked at it and they saw it on the order, so they went, I better try and get him in.
That was a good move.
Well, I needed to do it.
Yeah, that was a good move, because I can see here now, even from speaking to you earlier on, the changes in your thinking.
Oh, yeah.
Around addiction, and
yeah,
particularly gambling, because I know how cunning that can be with all addictions. Like that still goes on for me there, where I might be passing a bookies and I can tell myself, actually, I'm not a compulsive gambler at all. I can go in there and maybe do a lot of numbers. I know for a fact I'm in there the next week and everything that I have is gone. You know, it's that.
Yeah.
It's that coming.
One of the bigger things that I learned with her that I didn't ever do work on before was the impact that my behaviour had on the victims of the crimes that I pulled, but also on my friends and family.
Mm.
I never cared about any of that shit before. All I cared about was myself. Where am I going to get the next week to do this? And the next recruit was always going to be the one that made me the fortune where I'd be able to pay back everyone and be set up for the rest of my life and everyone would love me. You know, that kind of way.
Yeah.
Can you speak to the piece you said there about the victims of your crimes? Because a lot of the time people look at fraud and white collar crime as like almost victimless.
For sure. The insurance companies are paying. Someone is paying. There's always a victim, you know. I mean, it's easy for me to say I didn't. And that was the way before that I always justified the crimes I was pulling to myself. Sure, I didn't go around betting up an old woman. I didn't take her handbag. I didn't break into her house. I didn't put a knife to anyone's throat. At the end of the day, I took money from people, which is wrong. You know, like the insurance companies, they have to pay people's salary. You know, at the end of the day, they were the victim. There is always a victim.
There'll be a lot of people listening to this now who may be victims of other people.
Yeah.
You know, and I can sense the sincerity in your words, and I can see it in your demeanour here as you're sitting across from me. You know, and obviously some members of your own family will probably know that this is you down the line because you're going to tell them.
Yeah.
And they will listen to this. What would you like to say to them, your family members or anybody within your family who may have been a victim to some of your own?
The one thing I've learned is that words are very easy to come by, especially with me. I'm educated, I'm smart, and I always had a habit of being able to say the right thing, you know.
Yeah.
To me, the only way I can really do this to people
is action.
Is for them to see me happy outside and to see me not doing this thing. Like, that's one thing that'll always stay with me is my mother and father, God rest them, they did everything they could for me to keep me out of jail. All those times, they bailed me out, more times repaid, more people that came knocking on the door for money. All they ever wanted was for me not to be doing the things I was doing. Like, I have two periods in my life where I can remember my mother and father being most happy with me. And those were the long periods where I wasn't gambling. You know? Like, so that's really the only way I know that I can show people that I'm genuinely sorry for the things I've done.
Are you nervous about getting out and maintaining your recovery when you get out? Or are you confident?
Confident.
You're
I know a lot
support.
More. Yeah, and I've done a lot more work on myself. You were talking about personal development and things like that earlier. You know, I've done an awful lot of work on myself that I never did before.
Yeah.
You know, I did a lot of projects through education in school, mostly. And I've done a lot of work one-on-one with chaplains and with counsellors.
And society is looking over, for more people like you, people who have experienced gambling addiction, and you've came through so much. Maybe the next route that you do go down is maybe down the route of helping people that are caught up in some form of addiction.
Well,
you understand it better.
I've done a lot of stuff in here, hopefully that'll stand to me when I get out. Like, there was there's a writing in prisons competition as part of the Listowel Writers Festival, which is a huge festival every year, and I've won the prize, the overall prize, for the last 2 years. But this year, because I'm in an open place like this and I'm given a temporary release program, I was invited down to Listowel a couple of weeks to receive the award on the awards night, and there was like a packed house. There were 600 people there, and I had to get up and speak about why I was there, and I was very kind of nervous about the whole thing. And but the genuine response that I got off of people afterwards was just incredible. Like, I mean, I was kind of half kind of hiding away and hoping people wouldn't come over to me afterwards and this, that, and everything. And everybody that just came up, just, you know, like, I got a standing ovation on the night.
You have a good way of words, obviously, if you're creative writing.
Yeah, but I enjoy it. Yeah, it's something I do. It's something I like doing. And it was a big part of what helped me get through prison, you know.
And does it flow, or do you have to put thought into it?
Bit of both.
Bit of both.
I'm a natural bullshitter. Like, I'm a compulsive gambler that's able to rob people out of money with my gob. So,
be a car salesman.
Well, there you go. So, yeah.
Just to bring you back a touch there, just for anybody that's listening, we were talking a little bit about gambling being the silent one, the addiction that you can't see.
Yeah.
But the devastation it causes when people find out what it has actually done, because we both probably know people who, men who probably have remortgaged their homes behind their wives' back and gone into maybe 40 or 50 or 60,000 euros worth of debt. We both know the devastation of that, where relationships are completely destroyed, and people's lives are destroyed, you know. What would you actually say to any man that's listening, a woman listening to this right now, and they're going through that in their own heads? They're struggling, they're racking up drug debt or gambling debts, they're robbing from this person and that person. What kind of advice would be meaningful to them at this moment?
I suppose, personally speaking, if I was able to swallow my pride back in the day, I probably wouldn't have gotten myself into half the trouble I did. And if I had the balls to ask for the help I needed. But in my case, and I can only speak for myself, but pride was what stopped me from getting the help that I needed, and pride was what stopped me from getting better quicker than I have. And anybody that needs help, don't be afraid to ask for it.
Mm.
You know, there's Gamblers Anonymous, there's a confidential helpline there that's open 24/7. Most cities and towns have Gamblers Anonymous meetings every week.
Tony's organisation, Extern, they're specialists there as well.
Yeah, and Gambling Awareness Trust, gamble care, and things like that. There's, you know, there's a whole host of helpful opportunities out there.
Yeah.
But I do think also that more needs to be done at government level. But that's completely.
There's another podcast in there.
Yeah.
Thanks for your time.
No problem.
Best of luck when you get out.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
God bless.
The Toonaries podcast is proudly sponsored by Inline Eco, your trusted partner in asbestos removal and re-roofing services across Ireland. Your peace of mind and safety are our top priorities. For more information, visit inlineeco.ie.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Flimsy stands slowing you down? Well, it's time to upgrade. Armadillo builds durable North American-made tablet stands and kiosks. We're so confident, we offer a lifetime warranty. So, elevate your business and visit armadillo.com. That's ArmOdillo.com and use code ACAST for 5% off. Armadillo, built to last, designed to impress.